I was asked to host the non-job related announcements portion of Baylag. So without further ado, if anybody has any announcements other than job announcements, feel free to stand up and make them. Okay, I guess, here we go.
Hi. I should hope by now this is a standard, but perhaps some of you are new. So, BayLISA, the Bay Area Large Installation System Administrators, meets on the third Thursday of every month, and that happens to be 2 days from now, so you haven't missed it yet. The Augusta Ada Federation Shuttle Exploring the Wilds of Open Source Space is meeting instead of on the third Friday this month, the fourth Saturday, which happens to be this weekend. So, if you're interested in going to the Augusta Ada, let me know and I could put you on the list and send you directions. If you're interested in going to BayLISA, you can check out their website at www.baylisa.org.
The Bay Area chapter of Linux Chicks meets on the second Tuesday of every month. We're going to start alternating between meeting in Palo Alto and meeting in Tiburon. And someday soon we'll also have meetings in San Francisco again. So if you want the information on that, check out the website at www.baylinuxchicks.org, and that should have the meeting days and times and directions and all that stuff. And pretty much it's for women only.
Damn. Hello, my name is Charles Paul. I need a room. I'm a good cook. So if you have a room to rent out, I'm sitting over there.
Tonight's speaker is going to be Seth David Schoen, although he doesn't like David in the middle of his name, so it's just Seth Schoen. He's going to be speaking about the current DCSS litigation going on in New York at the moment. He's very well acquainted with the case and also has two DCSS t-shirts. So what better speaker than Seth Schoen?
Thanks. Many Baylag meetings have had speaker announcements very much at the last minute, I am given to understand in recent memory. So I am the Baylag speaker as of approximately 4 hours ago. So this is one of these talks where people have been told, oh, that would be an interesting subject. You'd be an interesting speaker. So I hope so. It seems that we have a non-job related announcement of asking for a new speaker coordinator. We have a call for a speaker coordinator. Any speaker coordinators? There is no speaker coordinator at the moment, which results in things like last minute. Art would be glad to hear from you. So hurry up. You find people who stand up here and talk about things at Baylag meetings. So it's non-job related because you don't get paid for it. But you still have to do work. Yeah. You don't have to tell the IRS about how you're the Baylag speaker coordinator. But you could put it on your resume or something. You get to meet all sorts of notable open source personalities or members of the Bay Area Linux community or things like that. Invite them to speak and thank them. Anyway, if this job appeals to you, you can let people know. So my name is Seth, and I am just as of a few hours ago, as I said, the Baylog speaker for this evening. I'm involved with various things. I work over at LinuxCare, and I am one of the creators of the LinuxCare bootable business card. Another creator of that is Duncan McKinnon, who has broken his arm. Otherwise, I expect he would be here. So if you know Duncan, I'm sure he would appreciate a call or a note. He broke his arm over the weekend. He fell a very large distance, and he's very lucky that he wasn't more seriously injured. I'm sure a lot of you know Duncan. I'm sure he'd be glad to hear from you. I talked to him today. He's up and about and doing all right, but there are a lot of things he can't do. So maybe he could use help from people with various tasks that he can't do without his right arm. Yeah, he is at home. I think he's going to be home for a while, recovering from this. So that's a rather upsetting thing. Duncan has worked with me at LinuxCare on the Goodwill business card, and he's certainly a regular at a lot of Bay Area Linux events. I have also gotten some informal involvement with DCSS and DVDs and such things. I have fewer qualifications than many people I know, but a lot of people here might identify themselves as science fiction fans, and I would say that it's in approximately the same sense that I identify myself as a DVD litigation fan. For example, I have gone out with people on Friday night to talk about DCSS, and more than one Friday in a row. So I'm a DVD litigation fan. I have two t-shirts. I have given a t-shirt to an EFF co-founder who has worn it at DCSS-related events. I have gone to a pretrial rally and heard speeches last week. I am friends with people who are working on the case, and I'm on two mailing lists about it. And I'm not a lawyer. So identifying myself then rather as a fan than as someone who's actually directly involved, although I have participated on a mailing list, which I will mention in a few minutes, I should say that the things I have to say are things that might well be familiar to many people here, because DVDs and lawsuits that result from them are something of interest to many Linux people. So I would basically like to give an overview of things that have happened, things that people have gotten upset about and paid attention to, and some of the issues that have resulted, some of the people involved. Tell people where they can get more information if they're not already sick of hearing about DVDs all the time. And invite questions and comments. I did go to a rally a week ago at the Bolt Hall School of Law at Berkeley, which was a lot of fun. And John Perry Barlow spoke there. And he got up and said that he was going to talk about some of these issues. And he made many comments which were very clever and interesting. And then he started to ask for questions. And it was a lot of fun because people were asking things and then other people in the audience were making comments. Barlow is not a great fan of hierarchy or someone being in charge of something. And it was very productive, so I would certainly invite people to give their comments on this trial or ask their questions and see if anyone can answer them. Lots of people have familiarity with this. Rick Moen there has been in person at a bunch of things related to the California trial, which is less high profile than the New York trial, but still potentially significant. So, let's see. The person up on the monitors is a Norwegian teenager by the name of Jan Johansson. Very few people have ever seen him in person before yesterday, I would imagine. Yesterday, he showed up in New York City at a protest and at a trial, which was being held over a program that he wrote back in October, or at least published. There's some controversy about this still, because he said in an interview about a week ago that he actually did write the program, except he didn't write the stuff that people are arguing about. He just wrote the GUI or something. So nobody quite knows about that, but this gentleman is just recently 16 years old. He was 15 when all of this stuff started. He is famous for being a member of a group called Masters of Reverse Engineering. They are pretty good at reverse engineering because they reverse engineered something which was presumably a Windows DVD player, figured out how it worked, wrote a partial equivalent for part of it, and released it on the internet. That was back in October. The program that they released is called DCSS. Let's see. Too many Netscape windows. Yeah. It's a C++ program which doesn't actually use object-oriented features of C++. And it's a C++ Windows program. It is free software. It runs under Windows. And as you can see, it's got a lot of capital letters with Windows programming magic numbers that will be very unfamiliar to Linux programmers who don't write Windows GUI applications. This is actually of some interest because people have said, well, you see, it's not a Linux program. It's got all these weird Windows magic numbers and Windows header files and stuff. This isn't going to run under Linux. Which is quite correct. So the source code is available. That statement should be made with some qualification, because most of the people who have attempted to make the source code available have been sued if their identities have become known. The source code is still available. I can't actually read this window well enough to open up any of the other source files. So this can be my excuse for not putting the algorithms and keys up on the overhead projector, but I would actually like to do that if I could manage to see the display well enough to go through the dialog boxes. But I should be able to do that later on. So we have this Windows application, and it sort of appeared as an anonymous post on a mailing list belonging to a open source Linux project called Livid, Linux Video and DVD. They have a mailing list called Livid Dev, and they were talking about all sorts of issues about how to play various movies, MPEGs, and DVDs, and VCDs, and various items on Linux. And all of a sudden, this anonymous message showed up, and it was the source code for this program, DCSS. People said, oh, that's funny. That's that algorithm that we couldn't figure out. They had been curious. Some people say they had been trying. The motion picture industry, when the DVD standard was being created about 2 years ago, had said, we don't want to release any of our content in a digital form unless it's encrypted somehow to prevent people from copying it. Now, they didn't necessarily believe that they could prevent everyone from copying it, but they wanted it to be difficult for the average home user to copy a digital movie off of something that you could buy in a store or rent in a store. So two companies, Matsushita and Toshiba, came up with this rather weak encryption algorithm called CSS, which stands for Content Scramble System. And they said that all of the movies that were published on DVDs could be encrypted with this algorithm, and there would be this extensive licensing regime. People who were manufacturing DVD players could license the CSS algorithm and implement it if they would subject themselves to certain conditions which the motion picture industry would approve of. And nobody else could know the algorithm, and presumably bad things would happen to people who did. This part, at least, was accurate. The nobody knowing the algorithm part wasn't quite so accurate, but the bad things happening to people who did part was rather accurate. There is also a licensing fee to become a CSS licensee. The idea is that a CSS license would be available to anyone who wanted one, as long as they were able to pay the license fee and were willing to sign the license agreement. I was told that the license fee was about $10,000, which is considered a nominal fee in some parts of the technology industry. In the open source community, $10,000 might not be considered nominal, but I'm not sure that that's the actual fee. The license terms are more of an issue for open source developers in that they require you not to disclose the algorithm to anyone else. They require a lot of other things also that we don't know about because the license terms are still confidential. They're expected to come out in the future during the California litigation, but the license terms are still confidential. Some of them were submitted as evidence, and we can see that there are a lot of restrictions. And the basic concepts are Your player should not allow people to make digital copies of the decrypted material. Your player should not allow people to find out the keys involved. Your player should not allow people to find out the algorithm involved. Basically, you should keep a lot of secrets from the end user. This is, of course, not something which is very appealing to free software hackers, who really don't care to keep secrets from end users. And so, more than the license fee, the license terms are a significant issue. For quite some time, people had been clamoring for a Linux DVD player. And this is kind of a mistake, because people clamored so long and so loud for a Linux DVD player that now even the plaintiffs, people who are suing, people who are actually trying to make a Linux DVD player, understand that everyone wants a Linux DVD player. Their response to this was to find that two companies, were actually working on a Linux DVD player and say, so what's your problem? Why don't you have patience? Of course, the Linux DVD players that are in progress are very far from being free software. They're proprietary with very strict license agreements, and you don't have to pay for them in all cases. One of them is available at no cost, I believe, but you're not allowed to reverse engineer them, you're not allowed to make your modifications, and you're not allowed to do all sorts of things that we would expect to do to software that we run on our computers in the free software community. Also, these things are vaporware and aren't available, but they're under development, and that's good enough for some of the plaintiffs, because they say, you need to have patience. You know, if your bank took an extra week to process your withdrawal request or something, you wouldn't break into the bank and take out the money yourself. So if the DVD industry takes an extra year or 7 years or however long to produce this Linux DVD player, well, you shouldn't produce it yourself because you shouldn't do things yourself because you should license technology from the proper authorities. Or such would be our interpretation of their message. Now, actually, they do express it better than that. And under the right circumstances, I'm good at making their arguments in the terms that they would. But I'm afraid that these aren't the right circumstances for me to make a very effective presentation of their argument. I just tend to make fun of it instead when I'm talking to a bunch of Linux people. So let's see. So the LFID people include people who are quite capable video programmers, people who are very familiar with the MPEG standards and things, and have been writing Linux video software. But they didn't have access to the CSS algorithm. So there was a question, should they try to license it and maybe have a binary module? For example, in some certain Linux video applications, there are binary-only codecs for proprietary and patented video algorithms. This is something that a lot of people aren't actually aware of, because it's sort of hard to get around this without getting sued, as many people have discovered. And so the more mainstream developers of open source video software have generally said, well, what's the smallest part that we have to keep proprietary? We'll enter an agreement to make that proprietary binary-only software that people don't have to pay for, and we'll ship it with our software. They've done that in a few cases. I don't remember specifically which of the popular Linux video programs, video players, does that, but you may actually find, if you're using a distribution which doesn't make very stringent distinctions between free and non-free software, that you have some of this binary-only stuff on your system to implement video codecs. Video codecs are a rather, not to be confused with video encryption, the codecs are generally compression and decompression, much like modems, except for compression instead of modulation. So you may have some proprietary software on your system there. It's a tough thing to get around. These algorithms may be not only considered trade secrets, but patented. Actually, they probably wouldn't be both, because things that are patented aren't supposed to be trade secrets, but some people have actually claimed that a particular work might contain both trade secret elements and patented elements. In principle, when you patent something, you have to publish all the details, and then no one is allowed to use them. Trade secret is the exact opposite. You keep all the details secret, and everyone is allowed to use them. So in neither case do people actually end up using this stuff. But in one case, they're allowed to, but they don't know it. And in the other case, they know it, but they're not allowed to. And that's the difference between patents and trade secrets. So if you have both in one work, it's very clever, because then people don't know the stuff, but might know some of it. But if they did, they wouldn't be allowed to use it anyway. So it's quite clever. And nobody has quite figured out whether the CSS algorithm, which is used on DVDs, is patented or not. That may be a very significant issue in the future. In the case of trade secrets, ordinarily, they don't have extraordinary legal protection as intellectual property. The idea is that if you steal them in a way which would ordinarily be considered wrongful, like breaking a contract, then you can get in trouble. If you just discover them through some legitimate means, then it's fine. You've discovered this information. You can use it however you want to. This is an approximation of trade secret law, and it produces many controversies. Like, if you had a license agreement that said that you couldn't reverse engineer something, but you did, what would happen to you? Is that license agreement valid? If that license agreement was valid, did you acquire an obligation not to reverse engineer the software, or to keep what you discovered a secret? It's very likely that the answer to that question varies from jurisdiction to jurisdiction. So then there's the interesting question, okay, what if someone took this software and lived in some country where it was okay to reverse engineer things, did this reverse engineering, and then emailed you a copy because you lived in a country that had better internet connectivity or something, and you'd be better able to tell people about it. Some people have claimed that something like this happened in October because Jan Johansson, whose picture I will... No, that's not him. I've got other pictures coming up eventually. Okay. He lives in Norway. Norway's laws about computer crimes are rather different from the laws about computer crimes in the US, and similarly for intellectual property. An argument has been made that in Norway, a license agreement which says that you can't reverse engineer something is invalid and unenforceable. But the people who did the reverse engineering didn't live in Norway. They lived in Germany, and no one knows who they are. But they're friends with this guy, and he lives in Norway, so maybe you can apply Norwegian law to them anyway. It's worth a try, right? People haven't even started to worry very much about what German law is because they haven't figured out who these people were. But you can make this interesting argument. For example, someone has written a program called DCSS Plus, which was published yesterday in Germany. Now, this program was written by someone, and people know who he is, but not where he lives, although you might be able to find out. They know his name. This guy wrote this program based on a description that a Norwegian cryptographer named Frank Stevenson wrote of a program that a British free software hacker named Derek Faucus wrote based on the information in the DCSS source code that Jan Johansson published in Norway based on the reverse engineering that two anonymous programmers probably did in Germany. So the question is, does this programmer, whose name we know but we don't know where he lives, have a legal obligation under California trade secret law not to tell anyone the source code to his program? And if Tom, who runs Lemuria.org in Germany, publishes it, even though this guy, who we don't know where he lives, might have had a legal obligation under California law not to disclose it, are you in trouble if you download a copy from Tom in Germany, given that nobody has managed to convince a judge in Germany that all of those people knew they were doing something wrong and were conspiring against the American motion picture industry under California law? It's an interesting question. I don't know the answer. Yeah. Oh, okay, so we don't know the person's name, and we don't know where he lives. Well, I forgot what it was, too. I don't have a copy of DCSS Plus. Okay, so... Okay, so we don't actually know what country any of these people live in, but we know that they're all different. So... Yeah. So we know where he lives, and he got arrested, because someone complained that he was perhaps violating a Norwegian law which was actually sort of unrelated to computers, but sounded good. And people showed up and arrested him and his father and questioned him, but nothing bad has happened to them since. He got a job as a result also. Well, I think he said that about 8 companies throughout the European Union had immediately offered him employment, and so he accepted one of the job offers. I was actually going to suggest that some Bay Area Linux companies might want to hire him too, but he's already taken. But he could be the youngest employee of your company if you're hiring, and you can handle immigration from the EU and such. But he likes FreeBSD better than Linux. Ah, so why did he write it in Windows? This is a big argument. There are people in court, not as we speak, but soon, who are going to argue that he completely made up the part about liking FreeBSD or Linux, because DCSS is a Windows program. Jan Johansson gave an interview to Linux World Online magazine in which he said, well, we wrote this as a Windows program because we wanted to write it for Linux, except the DVD's file system, which is called UDF, wasn't in the Linux kernel yet. But the UDF drivers were available for 32-bit Windows, Win32 platforms, so we could write our proof of concept under Windows, and it would work. Whereas to run this stuff on Linux, you would need this DVD file system support that didn't exist, so there wouldn't have been any way to test it. FreeBSD at least didn't have UDF support in October. I'm not sure whether they do now. I wouldn't be surprised if they did. Linux has gotten UDF support since then. So this sounds like a fairly strong argument in that there was this operating system that can talk to DVDs and this operating system that can't talk to DVDs. So if you want to demonstrate something that works with DVDs, you might want to write it for the operating system that can talk to DVDs so that people can use it or at least try it out. On the other hand, a lot of Linux programmers aren't particularly known to write proof of concepts of things under Windows. They're known to try to get Linux drivers. So it seems like Jan Johansson may be a dual boot sort of person, in which case he can presumably be forgiven for writing a Windows program. Other people can be forgiven for writing Windows programs also, but it's particularly easy to forgive people who dual boot. So Jan Johansson is not a cryptographer. He does seem to know how to write Windows GUI applications, and he does seem to know quite a bit about multimedia now, but he's not a computer security expert or a reverse engineering expert or anything. A few cryptographers and computer security experts have looked at this code after it was published. They said, wow, that's a really weak crypto system. It uses a 40-bit key, and we could break those in 3.5 hours by brute force before, but there are some shortcuts so we can break it in 16 seconds or maybe 4 seconds. So it's not that strong. But, well, the motion picture industry said, yeah, but you couldn't export anything more than 40 bits back in October. And actually they were wrong, because one of the very oldest exceptions in the crypto export regulation was for copy protection schemes. That was one reason that you could export something more than 40 bits, but they said, well, we couldn't. If I may engage in speculation, which I wouldn't do in court or in a deposition, the actual reason that it was 40 bits was that the consumer electronics industry has a bit of a rivalry with the motion picture industry. The consumer electronics industry wants to make devices that are somewhat inexpensive, lightweight, and full-featured. The motion picture industry does not necessarily want... motion picture industry would like to have devices which are inexpensive, lightweight, and full-featured, but wouldn't necessarily like them to be sold in stores if they're able, for example, to make digital copies of movies. So, interestingly enough, in a lot of the laws which have been passed about digital multimedia equipment, there's a distinction made between consumer equipment and professional equipment. Professional equipment is almost completely unregulated. I forgot what the definition is. It seems like something that costs more than a certain amount. It's almost completely unregulated. It doesn't have to implement any copy protection or anything. And there have been... yeah. Yeah, that's right. The serial copy management system for DAT, for digital audio tapes.
Law
Yeah, if you look on the Free Software Foundation's website, Richard Stallman wrote an essay some years ago called The Right Way to Tax Debt. This was an issue years back now when digital audio tapes were being introduced. The recording industry lobbied Congress and got a law passed which said that there would be a tax on all digital audio tapes imported or sold in the United States. And copyright holders would apply to the Copyright Office to receive compensation paid out of this tax. This law is still in force. If you are a copyright holder in a published musical work and you're not represented by the recording industry, you can actually go to the Copyright Office run by the Librarian of Congress and ask for your share of the DAT tax, and you'll presumably be paid like 20 cents or 50 cents or something to compensate you for the piracy that was presumed to occur as a result of the sale to consumers of digital audio tapes. Okay, so yeah, DAT tapes are being used for other things than audio most of the time now. But the recording industry didn't know that, so they got this tax passed on them. Richard Stallman was very unhappy about this. He didn't think that the recording industry should control technologies in this way. But that was hardware. And as of last year, there is now a law which purports to affect software in the same way. This very famous law is the Digital Millennium Copyright Act. It was passed and signed last year. This is actually not the act. This is the statute, Title 17 of the United States Code, Section 1201. There are actually other parts of this law which are codified at other places in the United States Code, and they're less famous, but they pertain to other things. There's another part of this law which talks about how to sue someone under this law and what will happen to you if you lose. I think that's 1202. There's another part of this law which says that if you're an ISP, you're not liable for copyright infringement if you do certain things to take down things which are challenged as infringements of copyright when people tell you about them. Some people think this is good and some people think this is bad. One effect that it has is it makes it harder to sue an ISP for copyright infringement. But another effect that it has is it makes it a lot easier to threaten an ISP and force the ISP to take things down. So it's easier to challenge things, but harder to sue people for them. Yeah? Well, this only applies to copyrights, so it would be copyright and not trade secret. This didn't affect federal trade secret law at all. So you can't use the Digital Millennium Copyright Act to claim that something is an infringement of trade secret and ask for it to be taken down. But you can... Well, the Church of Scientology claims copyright in a bunch of things which are being published on the net. And they're always trying to get people to take them down. They've also claimed that some of those things are trade secrets. So this law wouldn't help them there. But for the copyright claims, they could say to ISPs, oh, well, this law has clarified your obligation to remove this, so you do, and you obviously have no liability. But if you don't, then it seems clearer that you might have liability. There's another section of the law which talks about falsifying basically watermarks. This section of the law almost no one has talked about at all, because no one has ever been sued under it. This section is kind of interesting. If someone puts a watermark in a copyrighted motion picture, musical performance, or some other work, and you falsify the information in that watermark to make it claim something else, I think even if you remove the watermark, but in any case, if you falsify it and make it say something which it didn't say before, then you can be liable under this other part of the Digital Millennium Copyright Act. People say DMCA for short, and I don't blame them. So there are all these provisions, and the most famous provision is this Section 1201, Violations Regarding Circumvention of Copyright Protection Systems. There's 1201A, which says that No person shall circumvent a technological measure that effectively controls access to a work protected under this title. This title refers to Title 17 of the United States Code, which is the Copyright Act. So in other words, no person shall circumvent a technological measure that effectively controls access to a work protected under the Copyright Act. This hasn't taken effect yet. It's still going to take effect in the fall. There have been these hearings concerning this provision, and people get up in front of the Librarian of Congress and people appointed by the Librarian of Congress and make long arguments about whether this law is good or bad and whether the Librarian of Congress should prevent it from being enforced or enforce it very strictly. There's this other part. There's 1201A2. No person shall manufacture or do these other things with a technology, product, service, device, component, or part thereof that is primarily designed or produced for the purpose of circumventing a technological measure, and so on. Yeah. Effectively. People have been arguing about effectively for a long time. People said, CSS is not effective. It's 40-bit, and we can break it in 4 seconds. 4 seconds is almost real time. Well, right, if it has only limited commercially significant purpose or use other than to circumvent. And this is or, this isn't and. So if it violates A or B or C, then it's illegal. It's not that you have to violate all of these. So one of them is primarily designed or produced to circumvent. Another is only limited commercially significant purpose other than to circumvent. The other one is marketed for use in circumventing. So this means that it could be illegal to write a computer program that doesn't do anything if you say in advertising that it circumvents some technological protection measure. So you could take BinCat and take out an ad in the New York Times or something that says, BinCat can help you defeat the serial copy management system, and you might be breaking the law. Probably people would just think it was funny, but it might be illegal. I mean, the thing is, it's generally illegal to give people stuff if you know that it will help them do something illegal. For example, if you know that someone is trying to kill someone and you give that person a hammer, when that person says, would you please give me a hammer so that I may kill this person, then you may well get into trouble under various laws. The fact that hammers are legal doesn't really help you if you give someone a hammer with which to kill someone. On the other hand, this law is a lot broader than that, because it doesn't say that giving someone these technologies with which to violate the act is illegal. It says more, if these technologies could be used to defeat programs which are written to protect rights granted under the act, then these technologies are illegal. Yeah? Well, so the question is, does the DMCA affect programs? I would guess like debuggers and tracing reverse engineering tools. There's a program called LTrace under Linux, which you should all check out, which can print out library calls that programs make. It's very clever. Not just system calls, but library calls. So user space libraries. I have never heard anyone claim that these things are banned by the DMCA. I'm not a lawyer, so it would be bad for me to say that they're not banned by the DMCA. Some people have suggested, Richard Stallman suggested years ago, before the DMCA, that someday a law would be passed that would make debuggers illegal. Some people have said that the DMCA might be the law that Stallman was thinking of. But I think that most people would say that's an exaggeration. You could say that it's a step in that direction, in that people have committed acts which could become questionable under this law using only debuggers and not using other software. Yeah, so if you publish Truss or strace and say, well, you can use this to... Okay, the first case that came up under the DMCA in federal court was not the case that I'm hoping to talk about sometime soon, but It was actually a case in Washington State where Real Networks, formerly Progressive Networks, but not very progressive anymore, sued a company called Streambox. Real Networks is the creator of the various real media formats like Real Audio and Real Video. And they don't generally tend to allow... Many people have noticed, for example, that there is no open source Real Player and there is no open source Real Server. There actually is one, except it's like 5 versions out of date. Someone came up with an open source version of like Real Player version 2 or something, which unfortunately not very many people are using anymore. Okay, so there's no current open source player for these media types. Well, the reason is that Real Networks considers these media types to be trade secrets, and they have some patents. I'm not sure what the patents are on. Huh? Oh, Real Player plugin module. Okay, RPMs. Well, so we can be mad at Real Networks for that, but I think these things about lawsuits may have more significant consequences than they're choosing the same extension that Red Hat chose for Red Hat packages. But that can be annoying too. Okay, a company called Streambox made an unauthorized implementation of a Real Media client. They actually made a few of them. There's a thing called the Streambox VCR. Everyone is trying to claim that everything is like a VCR. The reason people are trying to claim that everything is like a VCR is that there was a lawsuit in 1984 where Universal sued the producers of the Betamax VCR, claiming that VCRs were inherently illegal because they facilitated Sony. Yeah, okay, Universal versus Sony, 1984, that's right. Federal case, they said, well, selling VCRs is a contributory violation of the Copyright Act. VCRs should be illegal. Universal, coincidentally the same plaintiff in the current lawsuit, said, yes, VCRs should be illegal because their purpose is to infringe copyrights by recording copyrighted material and making unauthorized uses of it. Well, they lost, so VCRs are legal. So this is why everyone is now saying, such and such thing that I have written is a VCR. Because everyone knows that there's a federal court case that VCRs are legal. So if they were right, it would be great because all these programs would be legal. Yeah, DCSS VCR. It should have been called that, right? The CSS VCR or something by Jan Johansson. Well, Streambox made something called the Streambox VCR. They said it works like a VCR. You can record a stream and play it back. And it had these features that the Real Player didn't, like the ability to save streams on your hard drive. You might have noticed that Real Player does not ordinarily allow you to save content to your hard drive, only to play it as a live stream. This gives the people who are broadcasting the streams much more control, potentially, because they can choose when and how to make these streams available, and if they want to withdraw a particular stream, it's gone. You can't hear it anymore. If they want to make a particular stream only available at a certain time of day, and not other times of day, you'd better listen then, or it's gone. You can't hear it other times. Streambox didn't have any of these restrictions. You could just save it, and you had it, and you could play it whenever you wanted to, just like an MP3 file. In fact, just like an MP3 file is rather accurate because they also had media format conversion tools, so you could save streams and convert them to other formats like WAVs and MP3s. Real Networks was not happy about this, and they filed a lawsuit, and they won. The very first court test of the DMCA, this anti-circumvention provision, was that the Streambox VCR is illegal as a circumvention tool, and Streambox may not distribute it without a license from Real Networks. So, yeah. Yes, this ruling could be appealed, but I don't know whether Streambox has any intention of doing that. There is an argument on a mailing list that I'm on. What? There are two parts. There's A and B. A doesn't take effect yet. A says you can't circumvent. B says you can't distribute technology for circumventing. So B is in force right away. A is not in force yet. There's this strange thing. Okay, so if it's illegal, there are exceptions to A that say, well, libraries can circumvent. But there are no exceptions to B. So there's no, you can sell a tool for circumvention to a library. So basically, the libraries have to make up the tools themselves, except they can't have them when they're done with them. But if they made up the tools themselves and used them themselves and didn't actually have them, they would probably be okay. But they also couldn't get them from anyone else. But they're definitely allowed to use them. They've got this very broad exemption that if they somehow had the tools without having them, it would be legal for them to use them. Okay. It's a weird thing. People have been making fun of Congress for writing this law this way. For enforcing? Well, you can argue that it's hard to use something like DCSS to enforce your copyright. Although that's actually not true, because if you're using watermarks, it could be very useful to you, because you need to see the digital stream in order to verify your watermark. But I thought of that argument, and a few other people thought of that argument, that if you wanted to verify watermarks, and someone else had published a DVD of a movie, you can't prove that it's your movie unless you can get the digital MPEG content to verify the watermark. Oops. And the DVD is designed to prevent you from getting the digital content back out, so you can't verify your copyright, so you can't sue this person, or you won't have a strong case as you would otherwise. Is that the sort of thing you're thinking of? There's a great controversy over this. Okay, there are two lawsuits that I was actually going to mention. There are three lawsuits. One of them people are ignoring. The first lawsuit was filed in California in Santa Clara County Superior Court last November, I believe. Yeah, in November. It's DVD Copy Control Association versus Andrew McLaughlin, Andrew Bunner, and a whole bunch of other people. More than 500 other people? 500 websites or so. It's very interesting because it mentions some people by name and some people by URL, and it says we haven't caught some other people yet, but we'll tell you who they are when we catch them. And these people are being sued for trade secret infringements under California trade secret law, which I've already discussed a bit. The claim is that these people, by publishing this program, DCSS, have misappropriated this trade secret belonging to the DVD Copy Control Association, a Delaware corporation with offices in Morgan Hill, California, not far from here. People could go have a protest there or something. Although protesting against the plaintiff during a lawsuit is not necessarily the best idea, because the plaintiff might tell the court, well, these people came and harassed our employees or something. But they're there in Morgan Hill, and they're the DVD Copy Control Association, they're a Delaware corporation, and they exist to license the content scramble system from its inventors, Matsushita and Toshiba, to presumably consumer electronics and software companies that would like to make DVD players, provided that they're willing to agree to these conditions, to strictly preserve the secrecy of these decryption keys and the encryption algorithm, and so on. And they've sued these people. And all sorts of things have happened. The Electronic Frontier Foundation agreed to represent people in that case, which was a big surprise to the plaintiffs because they didn't think that the defendants were going to have any lawyers. So the defendants showed up in court with a whole bunch of supporters from the local Linux community who had heard about the thing on a mailing list and just showed up in court to show their support, and an actual real-life lawyer from the Electronic Frontier Foundation who came down and said to all the defendants who were there, I want to represent you. So they said, okay. And she got up in court, Robin Gross, and she defeated the request for the temporary restraining order. Now, unfortunately, they came back right after that and got a preliminary injunction entered, and these people are forbidden to publish DCSS anymore, which is very depressing. And there is this threat against the open source Linux DVD player Livid. For example, the lead developer of Livid, Matthew Pavlovich, is a named defendant in this California trade secret lawsuit. This is something that a lot of people were neglecting for a while. They're saying, well, DCSS is a Windows program, and It's not a Linux program, and DCSS is more obviously useful to people who want to make illegal copies of DVDs. So we don't really have to worry about the Livid project being attacked. But the Livid project learned about the CSS algorithm from a description which was published by this Norwegian cryptographer, Frank Stevenson, after he read, Derek Faucus read DCSS, and Frank Stevenson read what Derek Faucus wrote and wrote something better, so Derek Faucus wrote something better based on that. So it's one of these great international collaboration things with source code flying back and forth on mailing lists, which presents lots of interesting puzzles for lawyers because they're not really used to looking at CVS logs and mailing list archives and stuff that much. They will learn, yes. And there have been more of these cases of discovery where people have been asked to turn over all their email and the entire contents of their hard drives and stuff. Generally people who have tried to involve themselves in the case in some way and not random people. But it has been said that random people who have had contact with these people might well receive subpoenas and be asked to turn over relevant information, email that they've exchanged about DVDs or related subjects. So this has scared a lot of people, the way all this email has all of a sudden been subpoenaed. And the Livid project had a copy of DCSS in its CVS tree, and Matt Pavlovich, its lead developer, got sued. This is kind of a problem. It suggests that perhaps the DVD Copy Control Association does not mean to leave alone video players for Linux just because they're players and not quite intended to facilitate illegal copying. So we've got this issue, and the Electronic Frontier Foundation is still litigating this. And just about 2 weeks ago, they filed an appeal, which is very impressive. I have a copy of it here. It would be probably difficult for everyone to read it right now. It's like 70 pages or something. Let's see. Oops. Oh, no. Is that home? Let me grab this. Sorry. I'll put it back to normal in a minute. Yeah, okay. Home, Baylog. Yes. So this is a rather impressive piece of work. It's actually Andrew Brunner, not Andrew Brunner. Andrew Brunner does exist. He's the person who threatened to sue... Okay, so someone sued the MAPS anti-spam system. And it wasn't Andrew Brunner. But Andrew Brunner was the person who threatened to sue them right before that. So Andrew Brunner is the Linux enthusiast who is actually appealing this order. What's the date? No, this is undated. Okay. Published July 8th. So yeah, 2 weeks ago. All of these cool lawyers for civil liberties organizations got together and wrote this very impressive appeal. They say the First Amendment is implicated by the restriction on the right to publish, even if trade secrets are alleged. This case is not about theft or piracy, and trade secrets are not exempt from the First Amendment. It is clear that the preliminary injunction is an unconstitutional prior restraint. The requested preliminary injunction will unnecessarily intrude on Bunner's First Amendment rights. They finally spell his name right. The balance of harms clearly weighs in Bunner's favor. DVDCCA. What? Yep. DVDCCA cannot carry its heavy evidentiary burden to prove that it will likely prevail on the merits because it cannot prove that Bunner misappropriated its trade secrets. This is where they get into the part about... if they can't spell his name. This part is where they talk about how all these people are in other countries and they actually wrote the program and nobody even knows who they are. So how can you prove that they misappropriated trade secrets if you don't know who they are? And there is this rather wonderful long First Amendment is implicated. There is no First Amendment right to steal another's trade secret. But that's okay, because the First Amendment will still protect Andrew Brunner and also all these other people who have been sued. So there's this long appeal brief. Okay. People should read this sometime if you like reading legal paperwork. Obviously, a bailug meeting is not quite the right time to read an entire appeal brief. But it's very, very well thought out. It's very nice. Hopefully, it will cause this injunction to be vacated. This thing is still going to go to trial eventually. There has not been a trial. So this is a preliminary injunction, a pretrial injunction. That's one case. So this case is like, this case is not very scary here in California, because a bunch of law professors have looked at this and said, well, it's really unlikely that these people could ever prove that these people thought that they were actually misappropriating something that belonged to this DVD Copy Control Association, because they had never heard of the DVD Copy Control Association in the first place. And the people who actually did the questionable things are off in another country. Nobody knows what the local laws were like. Nobody knows who they are. Nobody knows what they clicked on or didn't click on. Sort of hard to prove a case under circumstances like that. Yeah. Trade secret law tends to require in California that you knew you were doing something wrong. The fact that someone wanted something to be a trade secret isn't good enough. The person misappropriating the trade secret has to have some sort of knowledge that it was supposed to be secret and that that person had an obligation to keep it secret. Here's the scary lawsuit. It was filed right over the New Year by all of the major motion picture studios in the United States against three people, one of whom you've heard of, perhaps. Emmanuel Goldstein, who publishes 2600 Magazine in New York City. He was sued along with these two other people who were just sort of there kind of accidentally because they didn't know what they were getting into. Emmanuel Goldstein does know what he's getting into. He's been getting into it for 25 years on purpose. So these plaintiffs, who are the major motion picture industries in the United States and say so in their complaint, say that these people broke the Digital Millennium Copyright Act by publishing DCSS within the United States. Plaintiffs are the major motion picture studios in the United States. Each plaintiff is engaged in the business of producing, manufacturing, and/or distributed copyrightable and copyrighted material, including specifically motion pictures. They mention Titanic and The Matrix, such recent blockbusters. Yes, indeed. They're so modest. Upon information and belief, defendant Corley. Everyone uses the word nom de net. It's very strange. It seems like the plaintiffs made this up and all sorts of reporters have repeated it. The nom de net, Emmanuel Goldstein. Well, it's French, though. It's not Latin. Yeah. Right, so the French language police will... Actually, that would be great, right? They could win their case, but then the French language... people could come, yeah, the Academy Francais could come and bring them up on charges of misappropriating the French language. It would be fun. Okay, so they're talking about how DVDs are this new popular motion picture format. They contain digital information. They don't want digital copies because digital copies are high quality. They have this content scramble system to protect things, developed by Matsushita Electric and Toshiba. Provide security. And they would never have published DVDs in the first place unless they thought that CSS is secure, which is not true. But I never got to the actual reason why they only used 40 bits, which I was going to mention before. So far as I know, the consumer electronics people would like to save money and make simpler products rather than more complex products. So suppose that you're making a Walkman, as Sony has done on occasion. More than on occasion, but suppose you're doing it for the very first time. You're making this Walkman. Now, you have a choice. Do you want to put a 4 megahertz microprocessor in your Walkman, or do you want to put a 300 megahertz microprocessor in your Walkman? Do you want to put an 8-bit microprocessor in your Walkman, or do you want to put a 32-bit microprocessor in your Walkman? Now, obviously, these aren't the specific choices that would be faced by someone making these devices, but the point is that embedded video devices portable video devices do contain microprocessors to handle decryption and decompression. The decryption and decompression that's done in a component DVD player that you would buy and put on a shelf is the same decompression and decryption which is performed by the CPU of your computer when you play a movie. And if you run Top or your favorite KDE or GNOME or your favorite desktop's load meter, you'll notice that when you try to play movies on your computer, the CPU utilization goes up. You might also notice that when you try to SSH somewhere, the CPU utilization goes up. When you try to run GPG to encrypt your email, the CPU utilization goes up. Okay, so a 40-bit cipher that might not be very strong is very simple to implement using less and cheaper hardware than a more secure cipher, which might actually provide more meaningful protection. In consequence, there is a very strong claim that the consumer electronics industry argued with the motion picture industry. The motion picture industry wanted a very strong cipher with a very long symmetric key length, and the consumer electronics industry wanted a very simple cipher, which would be much easier for them to implement in hardware and make for cheaper to produce, lighter weight devices with lower power consumption, perhaps longer battery life. The consumer electronics industry and motion picture industry presumably eventually reached a compromise in which they implemented this 40-bit crypto system, which was also very weak, but oh well. And so they claim in this complaint that these people knew that DCSS would let you copy DVDs, break this encryption, violate the Digital Millennium Copyright Act. 1201A2, no person shall manufacture, import. Note they include technology, product, service, device, component, or part thereof. The plaintiffs have said that this applies to software. In the past, there were some regulations on hardware that would defeat copy protection systems, but the plaintiffs have said that the Digital Millennium Copyright Act is also banning software that circumvents copy protection systems. This immediately got many people in the free software community very, very concerned. When Richard Stallman says, "Think of free speech, not free beer," he has a very specific point in mind. He believes that there is a free speech right to publish computer programs. So it didn't take very long to get civil liberties organizations interested in this. Although, interestingly, the ACLU has not been very enthusiastic about it. The Electronic Frontier Foundation has been very enthusiastic about this. A new hot case for them to follow, strain their resources. If you agree with my point of view on all this, you should go give some money to the Electronic Frontier Foundation, because they're burning through great deal of money. I mean, if you think of the costs of running an internet startup, you can burn through a lot of money very quickly. So, proportionately, being involved in a lawsuit is even more expensive than that, which is fairly amazing, because there are a few things that are more expensive than running an internet startup. But pound for pound, so to speak, litigation is more expensive. Yeah. They do have an office here in the city, 1550 Bryant. They're in the south of Market. They're nearby LinuxCare. They're nearby Dolby. They're nearby ZDTV. They're nearby a supermarket. Yeah, Safeway, yeah. I know some people there. I'm not sure that I'm the best person to do that. There might be a better way of arranging that. Like, I'm not an authorized representative of the EFF or anything. I am, like, I'm physically possible of handing, I'm physically capable of handing them money, and I work near them, but I don't represent them. So it's probably most appropriate for all of you who are able and so inclined and interested to go there or give it to them online with a credit card or something. If there's anyone who really doesn't have a way to get money to the EFF, you can come and talk to me, and I would be happy to try to take them some money for you. But I think that most people will probably have more convenient and more appropriate ways to make donations. Taking up a collection is cool, though. At their rally, they passed around John Gilmore's hat. John Gilmore wasn't there, but his hat was, and they passed it around, and they got quite a bit of money. Apparently, John Gilmore used to pass around his hat at meetings to get people to give money to the EFF, so they thought it was a good old tradition. They got him to send his hat. He was up in Oregon. So there's this lawsuit, and they say they want a preliminary and permanent injunction against the defendants and all other persons in active concert or privity or in participation with them, enjoining them from posting on the web or doing these other things to DCSS, posting on the web any technology or other things that circumvent CSS, or that they say circumvent CSS, and for damages in such amount as may be found, requiring them to account for and pay over all profits. Alternatively, $2,500 for each active circumvention device product component offer, or other such amount as may be proper. You could interpret this as a request for $2,500 for every copy of DCSS that was downloaded from the defendants' websites, or $2,500 for every time the defendant told someone on his website that you could download DCSS. That would be an offer, right? An offer to provide. So this could add up to a bit of money because 2600 Magazine has a rather popular website. Also, plaintiff's attorney fees and costs, interests, costs, and such other further relief. Hope the plaintiffs don't win. The trial started yesterday. That's why this is actually timely, topical, and relevant. This trial has been on a very expedited schedule. It's a very hot issue. There's a lot of press coverage. The trial started yesterday in New York at 500 Pearl Street at the Southern District of New York Courthouse. Yeah, there were hearings in Congress about Napster. There were hearings run by the Library of Congress about the Digital Millennium Copyright Act, and people talked about DCSS there. Some of those were at Stanford, and a bunch of local Linux people went to those and had a protest. This building in the background of the picture there is the courthouse where the trial started yesterday. This is Jim Gleason, whom some of you may know, and Emmanuel Goldstein, or Eric Corley, publisher of 2600 Magazine. Where is this? Yes, okay. So this is yesterday, 7/17. There was a large demonstration where the New York Linux Users Group got a whole bunch of people to protest outside of the courthouse against the DMCA. It was said to be very exciting. You can see some pictures. There's a whole picket line. People were holding up signs, "I want my Linux DVDs," other good stuff. People have source code on the back of their t-shirts. This is a subject of some confusion. So the code on the back of this person's t-shirt in the picture is not DCSS, it's CSS Auth by Derek Faucus, which is based on DCSS, but it's not DCSS. CSS Auth is a library that's part of the Livid player. It's not the same as DCSS. So a lot of people who wear this t-shirt don't know that, and they'll say that DCSS is on the back of their t-shirt, which is wrong, so you should correct them. Please. There's another picture of the protest line here. You can see all this on the web. Journalists. Okay, here's a great picture. Richard Stallman is over here. The resolution of this isn't great. You should look at it on the web. There's a link from www.nylug.org, the New York Linux Users Group. They organized the protest. This is Richard Stallman, and he's talking to a reporter from CNN, and this is the New York Police Department guarding them. So Richard Stallman was being guarded by the New York Police Department for giving his interview with CNN about the Digital Millennium Copyright Act outside of this federal courthouse. And Richard Stallman was on CNN, I'm told. New York Police Department standing around protecting the courthouse. I guess they're protecting him from CNN. Here, a congressman randomly walked by, and people started to hand him some documentation. I have no idea who he is, but they said he's a congressman, and he walked by, saw these people protesting outside of a federal courthouse, and said, hey, what's the problem here? Gerald Nadler. Maybe state congress? I don't know who. Brooklyn. When they say someone is of Brooklyn, it usually means state assembly rather than U.S. Congress. This is cool. Jan Johansson came from Norway to attend the protest and the trial. He was there in person on the picket line. More excitingly, he was there in person in the gallery in the trial. And Frank Stevenson, the cryptographer from Norway, was testifying. This is just yesterday. And he was giving testimony, and one of the plaintiff's attorneys said, did you write DCSS? And so he said, in some very dramatic way, which I wish I had been there to hear, something like, no, I didn't. But one of the people who did is right here in this courtroom, and pointed him out. And the plaintiffs were so shocked, because they had absolutely no idea that Jan Johansson was there, and they just like turned around like, wow, that guy wrote the program that this lawsuit was. They were very, very impressed. Also, they were probably very impressed that he was 16. And so actually, Jan Johansson has been named as a defendant in the California case. That also happened in the past 2 weeks. He was added to the list of defendants. Now, he lives in Norway, so there's this interesting case of whether he can be brought to trial in a civil action in California for violating California trade secret law off in Norway. But he was named. His father has been very supportive of his efforts, which is especially nice because his father was arrested for them. So if you had a kid and your kid wrote a computer program and some motion picture studios in another country got the police to come out to your house and arrest you and your kid and interrogate you about the program that your kid wrote, would you take your kid on a vacation to that other country because he wanted to attend the lawsuit? Because that's what Jan Johansson's father did. And it was very nice of him. So everyone should really thank Jan Johansson's father. His name is Per Johansson. Sounds like he's a really cool guy. I think he might actually be this person over here on the left. I'm not positive. Yeah, he gave his son the web space where the program was originally published. I think they have all their computers back. They confiscated Jan Johansson's cell phone, which made a lot of people mad. But the thing is that the cell phones in Europe are like more powerful than Palm Pilots, and you can play Tetris on them and stuff. So I'm actually told that someone was trying to write a DCSS port for a cell phone. So maybe he did have a version of DCSS in his cell phone. You never know. People have put up artistic renderings of the DCSS source code. There's a lot of effort to establish that there is free speech value in allowing people to publish this code on the internet. I actually personally have the intention to commission a folk song about the CSS algorithm, which needs to have three properties. It needs to have a catchy tune. I'm actually looking. The free speech activist in Boston has actually said that he'll put up some money for a folk song. I want it to have a catchy tune. It should contain all the technical information necessary for a skilled C programmer to implement the CSS algorithm. And also, it should be simple enough that a person unfamiliar with computers can memorize it and sing it. Then we need to get people to play it on the radio. Okay. Well, I'm sure Richard Stallman will be glad to sing it, but... No, we need to get a bunch of 15-year-old kids in other countries to start singing this song. That would be the really exciting thing. And so then, you know, someone would be writing a DVD player, and someone would say, oh, yeah, well, my cousin who lives in Sweden knows this song that could really help you. So that's what I'm hoping for. And so the interesting thing then would be to see if someone is actually willing to file a lawsuit against people who sing the song in public under trade secret law, or if they argue that the song is a technology product device component or part thereof, which is primarily designed for the purpose of circumventing a technological protection measure which effectively controls access to a work protected under this title, Title 17. Yeah, okay. So this trial is going on, and there's lots of stuff, and there are depositions. All sorts of people have been deposed. It's a big media circus. The EFF collected a bunch of donations, I believe from John Gilmore and from many concerned people in the Linux community, to support the defense. And they hired a very flamboyant and noted lawyer in New York named Martin Garbus. This guy is fairly famous, and he's very, very aggressive, and he really loves publicity. So the MPAA really loves publicity too. They're pretty good at it. So the MPAA has been putting out press releases and giving interviews and writing op-eds, and Jack Valenti has been in all sorts of newspapers talking about DCSS. Well, they deposed him, and they asked him, have you ever heard of 2600 Magazine? And he said, yeah, I think so. They said, well, what does 2600 Magazine do? He said, well, they put my picture on a t-shirt. That was all he could think of, though. He had also never heard of Emmanuel Goldstein. So perhaps Jack Valenti didn't know that much about DCSS, but he did write some op-eds about how it was pretty bad and it would let people pirate movies. And he may well have had a point, but it was interesting to see that he hadn't heard of the defendant in the case that was brought by the members of the organization he's been president of for over 30 years. But all right. There's been all sorts of publicity and all sorts of press releases and rallies and press conferences and protests, and it's a great big issue that's a lot of fun. Yeah. Yeah, a lot of the entities that are reporting on this do have business relationships with or under common control with some of the plaintiffs. On the other hand, there are journalists who actually filed court papers, motions against the plaintiffs, arguing that they should have access to material that the plaintiff said was confidential, and so on. So clearly not all media are siding with the plaintiffs. The New York Times actually filed a brief in support of the defendants, arguing that linking to controversial materials that someone is trying to suppress is appropriate journalistic practice. So the New York Times Online, I think, chief editor or webmaster or someone who runs part of the New York Times Online submitted a brief saying, if there's a controversy, then linking to the controversial materials from your online newspaper is appropriate journalism. So not all media is just supporting the plaintiffs. Yeah. Yeah, let me do that, and then let me take questions and comments of people, because I've been talking about lawsuits and DVDs for quite a while now. The site that's now run by Matthew Pavlovich, the lead developer of the Livid project, is opendvd.org. That's a fairly basic overview site, which has gotten a lot nicer since he took it over. And he does explain how he's writing a Linux DVD player, and this code is important to the Linux DVD player, and reasons why the public might not want to let the studios have control over the DVD format in this way. I host cssfac.org, which is actually down today because the Linux Cabal shut down, and it was at Linux Cabal. The Linux Cabal is going to be moving, but it's unfortunately down in the meantime. That site will be back up tonight. cssfac.org, I don't have any editorial control over. That's a frequently asked questions document, which is maintained by some volunteers in the Open Law Forum, which is another thing to look at. Openlaw.org is run by the Harvard Law School, the Berkman Center for Internet and Society, which is run by Professor Larry Lessig, who wrote Code and Other Laws of Cyberspace, which many people are interested in. Professor Lessig has a big interest in this case. He's not directly involved in it, but he's given a number of interviews and written articles about it, and he has pioneered this concept that if free software programmers can set up a mailing list and chat about stuff and make progress, people who are involved in litigation should be able to do the same thing. So he's pioneered this concept of open law, which is to say, basically, having a public mailing list where you discuss your legal strategy. Most lawyers would presumably say that this is an extremely bad idea. But the defense team in this federal lawsuit in New York has been grateful for all the technical expertise and perhaps some amount of legal expertise that volunteers in this public mailing list have contributed. And it seems that they've actually mentioned things in court that came up there, and they've actually filed papers in court, declarations, of people who volunteered on this mailing list. This guy said, oh, I'm a sysadmin at UMass Amherst, and I know enough from my sysadmin experience to help debunk their claims about piracy on college campuses. So he filed a declaration, and he was actually deposed. And they interviewed him for hours and hours and hours and said, isn't what you're saying about piracy on college campuses wrong? And he said, no, it's not. No, it's not. What you're saying about piracy on college campuses is wrong. So that was neat. And he signed up on this open law mailing list. And it's all public, out in the open. Everything's on the web. So you've got openlaw.org. There's a public mailing list you can get on. Yeah? EFF.org. http://www.eff.org/. Don't forget the trailing slash. You can save 302. What? The web server will redirect you, you know. So, yeah, openlaw.org, opendvd.org. The CSS FAQ at cssfaq.org is a little bit out of date. It hasn't been updated for about a month, I think. The trial was starting and people got busy writing things. Actually, the people in the Open Law Forum actually filed a brief, a friend of the court brief, in the New York case, arguing that no matter what, the 2600 magazine should have the right to link to copies of DCSS on the net. That brief was very nice. People went back and forth and back and forth over it and came up with all sorts of things and all sorts of precedents. Quite exciting. The brief ended up being written by lawyers and law professors, but based on arguments that had been outlined and originated by basically Linux programmers and random interested people, including a physicist. So, you know, people who aren't lawyers, but who care about this issue. Clearly the lawyers still do have more relevant expertise, but there are a lot of places where they could use some help in filling in gaps in their knowledge. Most of these lawyers don't have a particular technical background. So, okay, openlaw.org, opendvd.org. There are some others. You can follow links from there. Let's do questions and comments if anyone has any. Yeah. MPEG-2 decompression on Linux. There is software MPEG-2 decompression. Livid has software MPEG-2. There's another player that has MPEG-2. MPEG-2 implementations are open source. Not all of them, but they exist. I don't know about hardware. Yeah? There are some very good comments about that. The question was, what effect will this have on people who might want to reverse engineer other things? Several organizations have filed friend of the court briefs in California talking about how they're really terrified that people will be very afraid to reverse engineer anything in the future if the plaintiffs win these cases. So the Association for Computing Machinery, the ACM, which is the oldest computer organization in the world, they were founded when computers were called computing machinery rather than computers. They filed a brief saying that the right to reverse engineer is very important and it's threatened by the trade secret lawsuit in California, and that if that lawsuit were decided for the plaintiffs, the right to reverse engineer would be harmed and progress in computing would be harmed in the future. There's also the American Committee for Interoperable Systems. They filed a similar thing. I've been talking a lot to a cryptographer at UC Berkeley, a grad student by the name of David Wagner, who is very interested in this issue. He's a pretty accomplished cryptographer. He's broken a couple of codes that were used to protect cell phone communications. And so a couple of times he's told people, well, you know, people could eavesdrop on these cell phone calls or make calls without paying for them or do all these other things because your code is no good at all and you didn't let anyone review it, so I broke it. That's the sort of thing he does. He was an office mate of Ian Goldberg's, and the two of them would just tend to do stuff like this, periodically say, yeah, we broke this cell phone encryption and this other encryption and this other thing, and just sort of every couple of months. So David Wagner has been very concerned about the effect that this might have on encryption research, because he says, generally, cryptographers and academics who are doing security research don't do their own reverse engineering. They tend to be too busy for that. They tend to rely on someone else reverse engineers something and provides a description of it. And then cryptographers use their skills to analyze the security of the system that's been described. A cryptographer is not very likely to sit there with a debugger for a week trying to find the algorithms in some particular proprietary software package. Cryptographers are not likely to be that curious. But if some person who is interested can reverse engineer the system and provide a description of the encryption used within the system, then the cryptographer may say, oh, that's interesting, I can break that in my sleep or something. Or, that's interesting, I'll try to break it. So Wagner has said on several occasions and in court papers in California that it's very important for security research that people be allowed to reverse engineer these things, describe these things, make these descriptions publicly available, so that academic researchers and people, pretty much everyone would agree are good guys, can have the ability to attack them. This can be threatened by commercial interests because you can have someone who might make cell phones. The cell phone manufacturer's interests might not be identical to your interests as the user of the cell phone. Just like the other parts of the consumer electronics industry, the cell phone manufacturers would like to make inexpensive cell phones. They might use security systems which are not very sophisticated. And it might be that a cryptographer would be able to find a flaw in these and explain to you why you shouldn't be using those cell phones, why you should be using something more secure if you don't want people to eavesdrop on your conversations and invade your privacy. However, if laws like the Digital Millennium Copyright Act or trade secret laws limiting reverse engineering cause people to be afraid to do this reverse engineering, then you might have a very insecure cell phone, which people continue to use for years and years and years and years, because the cryptographers don't think it's really exciting to delve around and work out all these technical details, because nobody's paying them to spy on other people. They're just doing research. So the people who are paid to spy on you and go delving around in your phone won't tell anyone, whereas the computer science professors, if they break the code, will tell everyone. So which one is a greater threat to the cell phone company? Which one is a greater threat to the motion picture industry? Perhaps the person who is willing to tell everyone, because then they have to say, oh, back to the drawing board, we messed up, we have to fix this. So the general concern is that if these laws make people afraid of legal action when they engage in acts of reverse engineering and such, it will actually be bad for security. These things will stick around for a long time because it won't be in anyone's interest to change them, and no one will be able to reveal their inadequacies, even though they're very inadequate. So I am told that I'm about out of time, so thanks to everyone, and I hope that people will be interested in finding out more about DVDs and staying up on the issue and such. Thanks. Oh yeah, there are actual other continuing parts of the Baylug meeting now. So thanks for the opportunity to speak here.
Let's go.
Give Seth another round of applause. Seth? Okay, just a few quick things here wrapping this up. I can't believe we actually went clear to 10 o'clock. First and foremost, we're supposed to be out of here by 10 o'clock, so as soon as I'm done speaking, make a mad dash for the door. Also, if anyone has jobs to offer or is currently looking for jobs, I'm supposed to point to an arbitrary corner of this room. Please stand over there after this is over. By the dumpster, yeah, right out the back. So, and also I'm told that there's a party usually after this event at Max's at 3rd in Folsom. So if you guys want to head on down there, and we have a hand raised. Yeah, unfortunately, I can't speak to that. Art and... Oh. Okay. Okay. Everyone got that? Okay. All right. Thank you all for coming. Have a great evening and drive safely.